This morning, the Climate Change Commission responds to the budget, saying there are some encouraging announcements, but it does not take the country far enough towards a low-emission economy. The Commission has written to the Climate Change Minister, James Shaw, with feedback on the budget and the degree to which it will impact the country's climate goals. The Commissioner, Rod Carr, says there are some good initiatives, such as the boost in funding for home insulation, 7,000 nature-based jobs and more funding for rail. But Dr. Carr says to really shift the dial in emissions reduction and meeting climate goals, the government needs to invest in large transformative projects from the $20 billion yet to be allocated. And he says from next year's budget, climate change investment should be added as a chapter heading alongside education, health and housing. Dr. Carr, good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Let's start with the positives. What did you see in the budget that pleased you?
Well, Catherine, I think the first thing is we all have to acknowledge the circumstances New Zealand finds itself in. And those parts of the budget which are still part of the emergency response to support New Zealanders, their health and their livelihoods, that is absolutely critical. And we at the Commission absolutely acknowledge that getting New Zealanders back to work, protecting and preserving their employment opportunities, and making sure they're safe and healthy in their communities has to be the top priority for the government of the day. On the other hand, the Commission has the luxury of providing advice to government on medium and longer term opportunities where the decisions over the next months are going to make a big difference in years to come. And so our focus has been to encourage the government as it makes the detailed decisions that still need to be made after the budget's been announced to continue and in fact accelerate New Zealand's adaptation to the impacts of climate change and reduce our emissions of greenhouse gases.
Is that a way of saying actually there was very little in the budget as announced? I know what you're saying about the next months, but that $20 billion is both in reserve for second wave of economic impacts, and is also going to be the pot to be spent effectively for many years to come. Governments will be grappling with the debt as a consequence of this year. So is what you're saying by setting out the way you have that there was actually very little in the budget itself that shifted things vis-a-vis climate?
I think more importantly, we're saying there are many decisions still to be made, although allocations might have been penciled in as a result of the budget. So already we've got the February announcement of infrastructure projects around $12 billion and a further $3 billion through the so-called shovel-ready projects. Now, the $12 billion and the $3 billion, in some cases, those projects are already essentially contracted, but in many cases, they're not. And it's not saying you wouldn't do those projects. It's just saying there may be ways of doing them that get us the 2-for-1, that get us the opportunity to both address the adaptation and mitigation that we need to do to address climate change, while also progressing either the job creation opportunities or the deferred infrastructure upgrades that are required. So we are really encouraging all ministers involved in decision making who are confronted with choices to look at them through that climate change lens.
What are the tools for doing that? Is there an off-the-shelf kind of cost-benefit analysis for climate?
There's no single tool, Catherine, but there are other measures of thinking about it. So we can look, for example, at a project that a minister might be presented with and be providing advice to his colleagues. And we're quite well adept at creating the benefit analysis and the cost of the project analysis in the traditional accounting and economic sense. What we should also be doing is saying, for example, per $1 million spent, what is the carbon footprint of this project? How much greenhouse gas will be emitted if we do this? How much might be emitted if we don't that would be abated if we do? So I think there are ways of putting measures around per $1 million invested or per job created or per $100,000 of wage cost. What is the impact on our greenhouse gas emissions as a result of the spending or investment program?
Is that work happening?
The tools exist. There's always going to be an evolution of the tools to make them better. There are various ways in which what is called the marginal cost of abatement has been estimated. There'll always be a debate about the exact numbers. But I think the risk is the pursuit of the perfect is the enemy of the good. So it's often the case that the orders of magnitude are all that matter here. That, let's take one example, upgrading rail. Upgrading rail, the tracks will be the tracks and they need to be built robust and reliable. But what runs on the tracks is what does the emitting. It would be a great travesty if we did not seize the opportunity to end up with low or no carbon emitting locomotives. The same question could be asked of the ferries that are planned that need to replace the aging ferry fleet that crosses Cook Strait. The choices we make about those ferries will lock in an emissions profile for the next 30 to 50 years. In my view, it is incredibly important that even if it means it takes a little longer, we take every opportunity now to make sure that we acquire the lowest possible emissions for the Cook Strait ferry fleet replacement. So those are the kinds of opportunities where the money might be provided, but the final decisions have yet to be made. The risk is it's always easier to buy the known technology. It's always easier to go with what was tried and proven. It's always the case that what's on the shelf looks like yesterday's technology. We have to be bold and have the courage, and if it takes a little longer to do the better thing, be prepared to do that better thing.
Again, I'm listening to what you're saying about buying what's already there. I'm aware of one local ferry project here in the capital that has electrified. But is there an inter-island ferry option anywhere in the world right now that significantly decreases emissions? How big a step and what might be involved in a project like that?
Right. So the first thing is I'm not going to profess to be an expert on marine electrification. I guess my point would be that the decision makers need to make sure they have challenged and tested exactly that question. What do we know? What is available? If it's not available now and we deferred our decision for 2 years, what might be available then? We are making a 30 to 50 year emissions profile decision. And therefore, we have to be, I think, completely open-minded to what the costs and trade-offs of urgency are compared to the benefits of further investigation. But no, I don't know, Catherine. I do know we're having built for us offshore electric tugs, so they're pretty heavy-duty beasts. There are at least two electric marine projects underway. So whether that technology is available to purchase off the shelf today, probably not. But might it be reasonably available within a time frame? Possibly so. So how might we make sure that we don't lock in path dependency to a high emissions transport fleet for Cook Strait?
You highlight housing, I'll quote, "We strongly support the energy efficiency gains, improved health outcomes and job creation opportunities from a bolder, larger and faster home insulation program. We assume a supply constraint explains the modest funding and target given the size and state of the housing stock." Has this, to this point anyway, been a big missed opportunity, again one you hope will be undertaken when future spending's detailed?
Catherine, I'm not privy to the analysis that was done that identified the targets which have been set, which is roughly just over $6,000 a house and about a $56 million pitch. So that deals with an important issue, but at a modest scale. There are estimates that there are possibly in excess of 500,000 New Zealand houses that are under-insulated. And the huge upside to insulating homes, whether they're in state ownership or whether they're owner-occupier or even if they're residential rental, is there are health benefits to better insulated homes. There are energy efficiency benefits to the New Zealand nation as a result of not having to use as much of our energy to heat the air outside the house, and more of it can be used to heat the people in the house. And then there are the realities that these are skilled jobs, but people can be trained reasonably quickly. They're jobs that would be spread throughout the community, close to where people who are available to work are likely to live. So from the point of view of jobs creation, health benefits, and energy efficiency, it's like you get $3 of value for every dollar of investment. But if the people are not available to do the work, then the risk is that simply the price of getting it done goes up, the skills are not available, and the quality of the works that's done may suffer. So you do need to calibrate the supply chain to make certain that you can do at scale a quality job. But let's scale up and get this done. We've talked about it for a decade.
Do you welcome the $1 billion set aside then for the likes of trades training and apprenticeships?
Absolutely. Not as a former vice chancellor of a university, it won't surprise you, Catherine, to know that I'm a big fan of training of any sort, skills training, education at every level. More is always better. And we need to make sure that what we are doing is making those programs appropriate for the jobs of today and tomorrow, not just what institutions were set up to train for yesterday. So the jobs of the 21st century and the kind of skills and capabilities that are going to be needed in the 21st century should inform the kinds of training programs. Now, some of them will be training of short duration, apprenticeships on site, learn by doing opportunities. They're entirely appropriate. They should be well supervised by people who are capable of passing on knowledge. Skills in the 21st century are going to require a range of digital capabilities. Whether you're a tradie on site or whether you're a computer or software engineer, the digital skills and capabilities are going to be ubiquitous. Electrification of everything everywhere is going to be important. So the electrification skills are everything from how do we build new renewable energy sources, how do we have the skills and capabilities to maintain the distribution or local generation of power, and then how do we make sure that we have the safe capability to plug things in and make sure they reliably work. So, you know, without going through an entire list of trades, there's certainly significant opportunities at many levels of capability to make sure we generate skills for the 21st century.
Speaking to your former colleague just last week, the engineering professor Susan Crumdike, who reduced the energy emissions from her own home by two-thirds when essentially taking it passive, we subsequently discussed that the state house building program about to happen could double as an apprenticeship training program in building these kinds of houses. This is exactly what you refer to again in your letter to the minister.
Yes, building new is a luxury compared to retrofitting old. We shouldn't underestimate the real payoff to fixing up the old stuff. I know the new shiny stuff is always built better, and we should make sure we build it better. And it's good to see that we are addressing the absolute shortfall in the number of housing units that the New Zealand society we live in needs to safely house our community. So absolutely agree that this is the opportunity to build the right type of houses in the right place with the right materials. So again, decisions have yet to be made about what, where, and how. But these are the opportunities that lie ahead for decision makers to look at those choices through the climate change lens and ask how much carbon is embedded in the building materials that we're using to build the house, how much carbon was emitted to create the materials that we are using to build the houses. It won't surprise you that the climate-friendly model uses an appropriate mix of steel, concrete, and wood. It's not always appropriate to use wood, but we know that when you use wood, you're locking that carbon up for another 50 or 80 years, leaving the footprint of the forest available to be replanted to sequester more carbon. There may be times when concrete is entirely appropriate and necessary. We need to make sure the concrete industry is using the most effective and efficient low carbon emitting techniques to generate that concrete. And if the world could create green steel, then we should be using that where we need steel in our structures. So at every decision, there are opportunities to test and challenge and measure and assess whether we are adding to or mitigating the problem of greenhouse gas emissions.
As we have discussed this with several people over the last weeks, the transition, I mean, you refer to large transformative projects, and we've talked also about the challenges of big transitions. Many things can get in the way, the politics, the risk aversion. You talked about perfection being the enemy of the good. Speed can also be an enemy, a sense of wanting to get things delivered. Systemically, what are your concerns about what you're calling to happen, happening? Like, systemically, are there changes that need to happen first or at the same time?
I think it's an at the same time. We don't have the luxury of lining everything up before we push go. The climate change agenda is already in action. So I think there are projects which now need decisions, and those decisions need to be made in a timely manner. There are other projects which might benefit with a little less haste to avoid waste, and that would be an opportunity to look at those through, for example, the six principles that we wrote to the Minister of Climate Change back on April 7th and said, use these as a guidance, you know. And I think there are lenses through which decisions that need to be made can be made that don't necessarily lead to significant delays or lost opportunities. So I would say that it is, let's do it together in parallel and get better and better at making these decisions.
What we have seen as a consequence of the pandemic and lockdown was a quite radical change to the way people worked and a suspension of normal bureaucracies. Is a resumption of normal bureaucracies going to get in the way of this?
Catherine, I think there's in Western democracies, there are processes that we strongly believe in about how decisions should be made. Engagement with communities, consultation with those likely to be affected, due process, rights to be heard. And in emergencies, those processes are suspended so that urgent and emergency action can be taken. And that we saw with good outcomes in terms of the health protection of New Zealanders. We need to also ensure that as we go back to normal, we challenge ourselves as to which of those processes must come back as part of normal to protect our democratic interests and rights, and which had just become layers of layers in the way we came to do things. As you mentioned, risk avoidance, bureaucratic layers, process of checking the checkers, delay for the sake of delay. All of those things we should challenge ourselves, because the climate is changing. The climate is not waiting for us to write Gantt charts and make plans and relitigate decisions. So we have got a sense of urgency. We need to act, and we need to act now, but we don't need to act recklessly.
Your place in this, you've written again to the Climate Change Minister. You gave the six principles as advice to ministers making decisions on these big projects. What else can you do? What else should anyone else be able to do to facilitate this?
Right. So, Catherine, I often get that question, particularly from younger people who are not in the positions to make these decisions. They say, so what can I do? And I've begun to answer it in several ways. The first thing that all of us can do, every day we buy something, we are influencing the suppliers of those goods and services about what they will supply us. Every dollar we spend is a vote. So I would encourage all of us to look at what we spend and know that every dollar is a vote either for a future low emissions economy or a vote for more of what we've got. And if you don't like what we've got, stop voting for it and express that through the preferences that you have as a consumer. Secondly, and quite importantly, we're all voters, all of those who are eligible to vote are voters. And that does give you the capacity to express your opinions to those who we elect to make these decisions. And in democracies, we get the elected leaders that we deserve. That in the end, we should elect leaders who will align our interests and their interests to make hard decisions. If we keep choosing elected representatives who defer, who procrastinate, who deny that we have to make these bold and hard choices, then we will get leaders who will avoid bold and hard choices. So as voters and electors, I would say we all get to make a difference. The third thing is that it is important to express, and we're seeing more of it, whether they are through business leaders or whether they're through our political leaders, to express the level of interest, anxiety, concern, and opportunity that needs to change what we do. That we are often employees or business owners. And in those capacities, employees can influence their employers' attitudes to things, and business owners, in an ownership sense, can choose how they use resources. So again, the third dimension is we are employees and business owners, and in that capacity, we can act. And then we have the fourth one, which is be well informed and educated about these matters. I think all of us have a duty to become better informed about both the challenges, risks, and opportunities that lie in front of us for the next decades.
We've spoken a lot about the $50 billion package as part of the overall budget, the recovery part, and we know full well that borrowing is set to double, an extra $140 billion rather of borrowing is set to go on future generations. But there's another big player here that is speaking out at the moment, and that is the institutional investment community, who have not billions but trillions of dollars under management, and are overtly saying we want out of assets exposed to climate change or causing it and in to others. Are they properly linked in at the moment?
Catherine, my first career was as an investment manager, so this is an industry dear to my heart. I would have to say that my observation is that the major fund managers of the world are acting in a way which is both responsible, but also naturally in their own self-interests. The reality is that many fossil fuel resources are never going to be extracted from the ground, that all of the assets which are listed in public companies cannot be realized because their people won't be there and won't be able to enjoy the dividends from that liberation. So it's not at all surprising to me that the major global fund managers are seeing the twilight years of fossil fuel industries extracting and emitting the way they have for the last century. So that's the we want to divest from part of that equation. The we will invest in is a recognition that now some renewables technologies are more cost effective than the old fossil fuel-based technologies they're displacing. So that creates the pull to invest in those opportunities. So we have to be very careful. The funds management industry is not a philanthropic industry. It operates in a hyper-competitive environment to seek out and maximize risk-adjusted returns. And what we're now seeing is the funds managers are seeing the risk in the way in which some returns are going to be generated. So that is reassuring that we're beginning to see rational decision-making around the allocation of significant amounts of private capital, private and institutional capital. So I am reassured about that. The challenge for New Zealand will be to get our share of those investable funds by making sure that we have investable opportunities to reduce emissions and capitalise adaptation. And there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to benefit from those capital flows as an open trading nation.
Thank you, Dr. Rod Carr, the Climate Change Commissioner.